Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Biomedical research is a multi-billion dollar enterprise in the United States, yet increasingly we're finding our ability to make meaningful change in people's lives is fleeting. That's because, according to the World Health Organization, only 10% of an individual's overall health is impacted by our healthcare system. The remaining 90% is affected by things like relationships, employment, education, food, water, and housing. My guest today, Dr. Jennifer Hayes Grudo, is a nationally known researcher who studies the impact of social determinants of health on populations. She was drawn to Tulsa by the mission and vision of the University of Oklahoma's School of Community Medicine. Dr. Hayes Grudo is my guest today in studio for Studio Tulsa on Health. Jennifer Hayes Grudo, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking you about your background. You have a degree in developmental psychology. Does that mean you practice psychology?
No, it doesn't. It means that I'm fascinated by how people grow and change over time. And when I went to college, I discovered developmental psychology, and I was afraid I wouldn't be able to make a living at it. But my professor said, go for it. You'll figure it out as you go along. And I ended up at a medical school right out of graduate school. And here I am, 29 years later.
And was that by accident or
totally
sort of by design?
Totally by accident. I took a one-year half-time job in Houston at Baylor College of Medicine. While I was there, I wrote a grant proposal to study weight loss in Mexican Americans. Now, I was so green, they would not have given me a dime. They made that very clear in the reviews that they wrote. But I had asked someone else to take the lead and be the head of it, and they gave us $2 million. So at that point, the department chairman of internal medicine asked me if I would like to join the faculty. And I said, you know, I think I would.
And you became, so you got very invested, shall we say, in research almost from the get-go.
What I discovered was that all of the theories and methods I learned about how children develop, let's say, language or social skills or how to think, those same kinds of principles and theories applied to how children developed health behaviors. So the next grant we did was to go into homes and observe mothers teaching their children about nutrition, what was good to eat, what wasn't, about hygiene, about safety. And we found they used the exact same strategies that mothers use when they're teaching their children to share or to care about other people. That is, the mothers who are successful. The mothers who weren't so successful use the same strategies whose children weren't as healthy.
So I guess it inspires a question to me, which is, we hear so much in the news about obesity rising in the country, especially among our young people. And so you have, I guess, in a sense, in your research, been able to elucidate what are the successful behaviors in terms of preventing childhood or youth obesity.
Yes, we know how to do it. We just don't do it.
So why aren't we better at it?
Well, because it's hard. First of all, it requires a lot of conscious thought. And most parents today, especially parents with small children, are really running as fast as they can. It's just a whole lot easier to stop and get a fast food meal or to pick up something frozen and pop it in the microwave than to go home and make something from scratch. And the first thing we know about how children learn is they watch us. We model for them. The number one thing to do for your children is to model the correct behavior. And then while you're modeling it, while you do it, you label it. You say, so this is how we eat. This is how we choose what's right to eat. We pick up a package at the freezer and say, oh my goodness, look how much fat is in this, or look how much sugar is in this. This is not for us. This is not what we want. But that requires conscious thought. It's just hard.
Does it make an argument, say, that for parents who are not effective at role modeling, that in a way we should almost, I'm getting to the early childhood part, or should we take them out of the home and put them in an academy or, you know, whatever you want to call it, a nanny state type of thing where we could teach them what we know, scientifically speaking, to be better, safer, healthier for productive and long and healthy life?
Well, that sounds good and bad.
Yeah, it sounds a little
no
scary.
No one, first of all, wants a nanny state because, and the main reason is science isn't always right. You know, we go back to Dr. Spock, who said, let babies cry in their crib and teach them who's boss and feed them on a schedule. Well, that has a downside, too. You have a whole generation of children who grew up hungry and are, you know, now looking for snacks every 10 minutes. I don't know if it's related. Maybe it is. But what I'm saying is science is always imperfect. Our knowledge, no matter how rigorously and strenuously collected, is never perfect. So what I think it argues for is taking what we know and trying to apply it in sensitive ways, applying it tentatively and getting feedback as we apply it. And that's what really what we call, you know, applied science or translational science. You hear a lot about translational science where you take what we know in the lab and see if it works out in the community. But it's not easy.
Where did your work on that grant take you, and where did you wind up next?
Okay, so we're working mostly with low-income children and their families, and we began to see those children grow up. So the next place it took us was into adolescence. And so then my research really centered around risk-taking behaviors in adolescence. This was also around the time that we were thinking Just Say No might be a good campaign to stop the drug problem. And of course, we discovered that Just Say No isn't enough. It didn't work. We still have a drug problem. And in fact, our research pointed to several reasons why Just Say No doesn't work. Interestingly enough, what we found in interviewing adolescents and monitoring them and seeing what they do and why they do it, if we ask them what the advantages, the benefits of a whole list of risky behaviors, everything from minor behaviors like sunbathing or eating fast food to really risky behaviors, sex without a condom, getting in the car with somebody who's drunk and driving, we found that we could predict their actual risk-taking behavior 85% of the time based on how beneficial they rated those behaviors. There are actual benefits to getting in the car with a drunk driver to a teenager that an adult doesn't see. They don't have to call home. They don't get in trouble. They also never assume anything bad is going to happen, and it's fun. They're with their friends. They're not getting yelled at by dad for going to a party and not having a way home. When we ask them to rate all the risks of those behaviors, it accounted for 7% of their behavior. So they just don't see risk.
Wow. Is that that frontal lobe thing you hear
it
about
is.
With adolescents not being having
They're
a judgment?
They're not fully cooked yet. That's what my husband and I used to say about our kids. He's just not quite cooked yet. And in fact, we know that's true. It takes to about our mid-20s for our frontal lobes to be fully formed.
That is so disturbing to hear.
It's so hard. Yeah. I know you have kids coming up.
Yes.
And mine are at the other end of adolescence, and so I can kind of breathe a sigh of relief. They had to learn some lessons the hard way. What you want is for them to learn the non-fatal, non-terrifying lessons the hard way on their own, but you want to protect them from doing anything that causes lasting damage.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Jennifer Hayes Grudo, who holds the Kaiser Chair in Community Medicine at the OU School of Community Medicine. And Jennifer, your next stop was involvement, I think, over a number of years in something called the Women's Health Initiative, right?
Right. I feel like we're doing This Is Your Life now.
This is your life.
Yes.
Well, what?
It was a detour. Here's what happens in research. You get someone who's humming along and doing really well at one thing, and a new thing pops up on the horizon, and either you want to go for it, or sometimes your boss wants you to go for it. And in this case, it was really the latter. My department chairman at that time said, "We really want to get this grant in Houston, and we want you to write the proposal." And I thought, wow, I don't know anything about menopause. On the other hand, all of my work has been primarily with women and children, and it's going to be so cool to be part of this national group of people who've been championing women's health issues for a long time. I don't know if you know it or if your listeners know it, but prior to 1992, it was perfectly legal for women to be excluded from all medical research. All.
Wow.
There were reasons for that. One is that, well, if they might get pregnant, and then we have the whole legal and ethical issues of exposing a fetus to a drug, they might respond differently. I was excluded from a study a friend of mine was doing one day at Baylor. It was on the effects of wine on your triglycerides.
Mm-hmm.
This is before I had children.
Sounds
I
like
checked
a good study.
It out. It was a good vintage. You got, you know, a case of wine, and you were told to have two glasses every night with dinner. And after 2 months, we'll see what your triglycerides do.
Uh-huh.
So I said to my friend, "Sign me up." And he said, "Well, you can't be in this study." I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, women might respond differently."
Wouldn't you want to know that if you're the researcher?
That was my thought. And he said, yes, but I would have to have twice the number of subjects if women respond differently than men, and it would cost twice as much, and it might not have gotten funded. And that was perfectly legal until the new NIH Revitalization Act of 1991 was signed into law by Clinton in 92.
Which said, essentially,
it is illegal to exclude women for reasons of cost or convenience. If you have a valid biological, ethical concern that you cannot develop protections around, they must be included. Because what happens was and still is, you have a whole host of drugs that were tested only on men who now are marketed to women. Half the antibiotics that we take were tested before 1992, and we take them.
And my knowledge of biomedical research prior to then is shakier. Were there studies that focused like only on women, exclusively on women, or was it they just sort
OB-GYN.
Of only in that literature?
Only in that literature on reproductive or organs that women only have.
Huh.
Very little was done. So what happened during that time was how the Women's Health Initiative came about is really a great story. It's a great story about science. In the 1940s, I think it was 47, estrogen was first approved. Premarin was approved for the treatment of menopausal symptoms like hot flashes and night sweats. And, you know, several 100,000 women, say, went on that drug over the course of the next 20 years. But in the 60s, a new book was published that was called Feminine Forever. And it basically said you could prevent everything from alcoholism to divorce by prescribing estrogen to your female patients at menopause.
What's not to like?
Right. And remember, in 1966, everybody wanted to be young anyway. So it was not just about staying female, staying feminine. It was also about not progressing to that next stage of our lives, staying youthful. And use just shot through the roof, as this drug is now marketed to keep you youthful, to keep you fresh and dewy. And so we saw a lot of women use estrogen, and over the course of the next 10 years, we began to see the rates of uterine cancer go up. And in about 1977, we saw that cancer rates for women who took estrogen by itself without any other hormone had about 7 times the rate of uterine cancer that women who didn't had. And they realized it was prescribing estrogen continuously without like a natural cycle where you have estrogen part of the month and progesterone the other part of the month. And when progesterone is added and then taken away, women bleed. Your uterine sloughs off those extra cells. You kind of cleanse yourself out naturally, and you could go to the next cycle. That wasn't happening with people on estrogen continuously. So they began to add a cycle of progesterone. Over time, though, women now are taking progesterone. Maybe they're in their 70s. They didn't really like taking progesterone and having a period, even if it's a small one, in their 70s. So they stopped taking the drug. So the makers reformulated the drug to have continuous estrogen plus progesterone. So now we have 3 different kinds of drugs over the course of the last 20 years that have been prescribed. Estrogen alone, estrogen and progesterone cyclically, and estrogen and progesterone combined continuously.
And all of this is being really from the viewpoint of consumer demand.
Absolutely.
And not in
not
any way,
science.
Right, not science and not, you know,
not
the
science.
Gold standard of a randomized clinical trial.
Right. But scientists being the way we are, we're always looking for opportunities. So researchers start to collect data long-term on women who've been on estrogen or some other combination. And what we discovered in the 90s, this was part of the Nurses Health Study and a couple of other studies, found that women who had been on estrogen since the 60s or 70s for 15, 20 years had a much lower rate of heart disease. And we thought, oh, that's wonderful. Now we know it's not just keeping reproductive organs looking healthy and youthful. It's also good for the blood vessels and the heart. And it stimulated a lot of other research on animals and different indicators like carotid artery thickness. And so we had all this kind of flurry of activity in the 80s and 90s about the benefits, the cardiovascular benefits of estrogen. We also started to see some risk of breast cancer. And so the question that came about in the early 90s as the Women's Health Initiative is taking shape is the benefit-risk ratio of taking estrogen with or without progestin on heart disease, breast cancer, and any other outcome that it might affect. We really thought going into it, we were there to prove the positive effects of postmenopausal hormone therapy on heart disease.
So at the time, were there critics who said, gosh, the NIH is going to spend all this money to study an outcome we already know to be true?
How did you know? It wasn't just any critics. It was actually the Institute of Medicine.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, so it was a big waste of money. It was $625,000 initially. Of course, by now we spent much more than that. But that was the initial layout. There were going to be 40 centers around the country, plus a coordinating center to handle all that data and the NIH as a project office. And I wrote the proposal to bring a center to Houston, to Baylor, and we got it. And then we went to work recruiting 3,500 women to our center.
Were these women that had never been on hormone replacement therapy? Oh, so you had different cohorts.
We did. We had women who were never on, women who are currently on but willing to go off for 3 months. We had women who had a uterus, so they had to be on both the combination hormones, and we had women without a uterus who'd had a hysterectomy. They could be on estrogen only. We also had a dietary intervention, which people forget about. Nationally, we had 47,000 women on a dietary trial to test whether a low-fat, high-fiber diet would protect from breast cancer. We had 27,000 women around the country in the hormone trial, and then we had almost 100,000 women that we just followed over time to see what happened.
Wow. All right. And how many years was it?
Well, it was supposed to be 8 to 10 years. We stopped the estrogen plus progestin trial early. We stopped it 10 years ago this summer in July of 2002 when it became apparent scientifically from a statistical standpoint that women who were on estrogen plus progestin not only did not have less heart attacks, but they had more heart attacks in the first 2 years. And after 4 years average, they had a significantly higher risk of breast cancer. And that breast cancer, in fact, was more aggressive than women who were not taking it, who were taking a placebo pill.
In fact, because we know most breast cancer is hormone sensitive, so in fact, you're then feeding the tumors,
that's right,
as it were.
Right.
And I was a young physician when that study was stopped, and I remember it was practically earth-shattering because the practice up until that point was, oh, here's a postmenopausal woman, just put her on hormone replacement therapy, and the only decision was whether to do, as you say, the continuous estrogen or the PremPro or what have you. So it really changed practice in a dramatic fashion to the point where nowadays it's almost verboten to consider doing hormone replacement therapy unless you have compelling reasons to do so.
Well, and now what we say is buyer beware. We have some risk data. So if you have such terrible hot flashes that you can't function, or if you can't sleep at night, that's one of the other symptoms we saw, then let's try it, but let's do it at the lowest dose we can get away with. Let's reevaluate in a couple of years. It's lowest possible dose for the shortest period of time today, as opposed to almost being like a vitamin pill when we started that study 20 years ago.
I want to shift focus a little bit to your work here in Tulsa at the School of Community Medicine. And I noticed you are a part of quite a number of organizations and boards looking at particularly early childhood. Can you comment on some of those?
Sure. After the Women's Health Initiative began to wind down and we were just following women over time, I went back to my roots of child health, and I was dumbfounded to see that in the decade I was playing around in menopause, the rates of childhood obesity had tripled in some groups and doubled in other groups of children. And I began wondering what was going on and became convinced that it was really more about the context and the environment that children lived in than it was about those children or their families. Nobody wakes up and says, oh, I'm going to have a crappy day, or I'm going to raise terrible children or unhealthy children. You're doing the best you can in almost like a polluted environment. We call it obesogenic environment, this environment that compels us to put our children in a car and drive them 2 blocks to the school because we think it's safer and healthier than walking with them or putting them on their bicycles. So we've got a lot of kind of contextual issues that we have to deal with. And I started trying to work on that. And that's when I was recruited to come to Tulsa. I'd been trying to work on those kinds of environmental and cultural and social determinants of our health. And when I came here, it was like I didn't have to explain that to anybody anymore. I joined the School of Community Medicine, and it was so fantastic that people here get it. It was like I had come home. One of the projects that literally landed in my lap when I came here was the Tulsa Children's Project. Jerry Clancy had gotten involved. It was a relationship that had been established between the George Kaiser Family Foundation and some researchers at Harvard at the Center for the Developing Child. There are some researchers there who have become convinced that growing up in adverse circumstances, in high-risk neighborhoods and in dysfunctional families puts children at risk forever. They call this the toxic stress of adversity. And they were interested in how they could apply what they had learned here in Tulsa. So I became involved in that, ended up leading that effort for the last 4 years. We call it the Tulsa Children's Project, and we have partnerships with a lot of people around town. It's been fantastic to get to know all of the different groups that have a mission and making the effort to improve children's health and development.
So in terms of early childhood education, Oklahoma is really one of the national leaders, is it not?
It's something we can be proud of.
We usually lament how low we are in most health outcomes, but it seems like in early childhood education, we've gotten the gospel, or we're just fortunate to have some benefactors?
We have some early adopters of some good data showing that when children who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, children who might enter kindergarten already a year or two behind their peers in terms of knowing alphabet and how to count, when those children are given a high-quality early childhood experience, they enter kindergarten looking like middle-class suburban kids who've had every advantage. That helps so much. It helps them not fall behind before they even start, so they at least start on an even playing field. The other thing it does, it helps kind of even out some of the rough edges. If mom is a single mom and she's struggling to work, you could put her in a low-quality preschool, or you could put her in one that's really well-organized using the latest principles we know about how to help children develop social and emotional skills as well as language and number skills.
And what are the statistics around early childhood education? I've read that every dollar invested in an early childhood saves $7 in, I guess, social costs, health costs downstream?
The multiplier depends on what outcomes you use. If you include things like teen pregnancy and imprisonment, criminal behavior down the road, it can be a factor of 20 or 30 in some of the studies. So it's definitely money well spent. If you think about when the brain is developing, we put a whole lot of money into taking care of people who are already developed, fully cooked, as we say, and we should be putting the money where every week makes a difference, every month makes a difference in this child's long-term trajectory of his development.
And so this work you alluded to that's coming out of Harvard, the terminology, I believe, is adverse childhood event. What are some examples of those and how they affect the hardwiring of the brain?
That work actually came out of California.
Oh.
And it came about because of the Kaiser Permanente research on what promotes positive health behaviors. They discovered that people in their obesity clinic who would relapse and gain all their weight back, they discovered by accident, tended to have had childhoods that were more abusive. And it took about 10 years to identify the important factors, but now we know there are about 9 or 10 kinds of events that if they happen in childhood, it puts you at risk for the rest of your life for hypertension, for diabetes, for heart disease, for cancer. It's like the stress of living in that environment as a child is biologically embedded in your system. These are physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, neglect, even something as innocuous as divorce, which at least half of us will go through, has an effect on children. and is one of these adverse childhood experiences. It's a really interesting area of research because it accounts for so much. It turns out now there are studies that are publishing data across 10 countries across Europe and other places in the world where we can basically show a stair-step approach from one adverse childhood experience to 10, the rate of other behavioral, mental health, and physical health problems goes up in the same stair-step fashion.
Wow. And you showed me a pyramid from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that essentially the base of the pyramid being these adverse childhood events essentially leads in this cascade of effects to essentially a lifetime of suffering and much earlier death.
Right. So as children are exposed to stress, just imagine that you're out having a nice hike in the woods and you reach for a blueberry and at the same time you do, so does a bear. What happens to your body at that moment? You can almost feel it right now when you imagine it. You can feel the adrenaline coursing through your system.
I'm running.
You're running. So we either do fight or flight. Or maybe we freeze if we're totally helpless, like in a dream, right?
Or in a movie like Scream.
Right. So you know right now your body is physiologically transformed so that you will survive that bear. Now imagine you live with that bear. That bear comes home to you every night and you don't know if it's going to attack you or if it's going to be calm. You're living always with that kind of adrenaline coursing through your system on some level. You are not focused on learning the multiplication tables or your ABCs or how to relate to other people in a calm, loving, kind way. You are learning survival, but it's not helpful when you get out in the real world. First of all, your blood pressure is going to be higher all the time. Your brain, parts of it that control fear, that brain part is getting more blood circulation. It's growing bigger and faster than the part that controls memory. This is documented. So what happens with this pyramid that they've drawn is that you have this basis of these adverse childhood experiences. Then you actually suffer social, cognitive, and even neurological impairments in your ability to function in an optimal way. That leads you to not perform as well in school, not get as good a job. You look for ways to soothe yourself that are not as helpful as they might be. You don't put on nice classical music. You don't meditate. You don't go for a job. You reach for a cigarette. You reach for a drink. You do something that has short-term benefit to your system to calm you down, but long-term bad effects, and you become less healthy. And eventually, it leads to premature death.
Wow. I mean, it's mind-boggling to think that something that happens so remotely in childhood could impact your adult life. And yet, I mean, I think this research shows that the line is fairly clear, especially now that you have this biologic imprinting that goes on.
What's interesting is that when we have biological data, now it's real.
Before that, it was all theoretical.
Right. I always tell the medical students when I teach this to them, don't ever let me hear you say it's just stress. Because we tend to minimize what we're experiencing mentally as if it's nothing. But when we have physiologic data, when we can say, oh, look, her IL-6 is elevated, so is her TNF-alpha and her CRP and her cortisol level, ooh, we have to take care of this person. Now it's real.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer Hayes Grudo, I feel like we could talk for another hour. This was wonderful. I want to thank you for coming to Studio Tulsa on Health and wish you the best of luck in your future research.
It was a pleasure.
Jennifer Hayes Grudo holds the Kaiser Chair in Community Medicine at the University of Oklahoma School of Community Medicine here in Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa on Health for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.